Say hello to a new friend on an old road. Take a two-lane trip of memories into mysteries unknown. Come along for the ride.
Yeah, Roderick.
Jim Hinckley's American.
Welcome to Jim, August 13th, 2023. It says live.
But there's no sound. Oh, wait a minute. Let me turn this on.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Wait a minute, that's music. Hold on, I'm on the wrong thing here. Okay, there. Okay, now I get to go back here. Okay. So there's no sound now. I don't hear anything.
It should be
live.
Yep, it's live right now. We're going with our theme music.
Yeah, I don't hear anything, and I'm on that link you gave me.
Okay, hold on. Let's. May have to do this with phone. If we have to, we'll do it by phone, Roderick.
Okay. I can do that, I guess, with this phone. But
take a two-lane trip of memories.
It's just,
folks, we've got our usual little bit of technical difficulties here. But we're glad that you're with us this morning. We're going to have a lot of fun this morning talking about bicycles, electric vehicles, coffee with Jim. How appropriate is that? We got a little bit of music from Joe and Woody and the Boys of the Road Crew. Always good to inspire a road trip or two. Isn't it great, this technology is so wonderful. Hey, we want to give a shout out to our good friends at the Roadrunner Lodge, Tucumcari, New Mexico, a true living time capsule. Great sponsor of our programs. And Tucumcari definitely deserves more than just a stop. You need to spend some time in Tucumcari to check that place out. And we want to give a shout out to our good friends at the Wagon Wheel Motel, Cuba, Missouri. This is not only the oldest continuously operated motel on Route 66, but it is, it's just a delightful little gem, to say the absolute very least. It's pretty darn amazing place. And Connie Eccles is a wonderful, wonderful guest. Speaking of road trips, if you want a trouble-free, worry-free adventure, United States or Canada, check out our friends at RouteTripUSA.com. Hey, Roderick, we got Roderick on the phone because we've had some little connection issues, but what's new with that? Hey, Roderick, how are you doing? Are you here in the States now, or are you still in Croatia?
You know, I'm still here in Croatia, and I think that's why I'm having the difficulties. I pulled up the podcast picture, but nothing's talking on it, so... But yeah, I'm still here at the moment, but should be back hopefully within a month or so.
Oh, that'd be great. You've been over there for a bit.
Yeah, quite a while. Taking care of family issues and stuff. We got family here. So is Kent hooked in yet?
Kent, I just talked to him. He's having similar issues, but... I think we're getting closer.
Oh, okay.
So you're not the Lone Ranger here by any stretch.
Okay.
What a deal. Hey, let's start with electric vehicles here, since that's how you and I got together quite some time ago. But, you know, I'm surprised, of course, now with the growing interest in electric vehicles, I think the Achilles heel still is the infrastructure now more than the vehicles themselves. But when I speak on this, people are really surprised that electric vehicles are not a new idea. They've been around for a bit.
Yeah, definitely not. You know, there's more electric vehicles on the roads in the U.S. in terms of centuries than there were gasoline vehicles with
them. I just read an article that in the Northeast Corridor around Boston and that area, somewhere around the beginning of the turn of the century, 1900 era, it was easier to find a place to charge batteries than it was to buy gas.
That's probably true.
Just one second, Roderick. One second here. Kent, how are you doing this morning?
Nice to hear your voice.
I think we've got Roderick and Ken with us this morning. Apparently, Kent, we've had some issues with the connection here. Roderick had a similar issue.
Okay.
We have Kent Bakke and Roderick Wild with us this morning. Gentlemen, thank you for doing this, and thank you for your patience on these problems. And it could be on this end. I was really worried this morning. We had no internet connection for a little bit.
Well, the sun's shining anyway.
Yeah, that's the spirit. Kent, are you still in Albuquerque on business?
No, I'm back in Seattle. It was a quick trip down there, but I did the walk up and down a few blocks of Route 66.
Oh, very good. We were just, Roderick and I were just talking about how, you know, with the electric vehicles today, people are really surprised to learn that electric vehicles are not a new idea.
That's for sure.
I was just telling Roderick, I just finished reading an interesting article in an automotive magazine that in Boston, in that area in the Northeast, around 1900, it was actually easier to find a place to charge batteries than it was to buy gasoline.
Wow, that's amazing.
Roderick, how did you get into this electric vehicle thing? I don't know. Roderick might be having issues here. Just one second. Do we still have Roderick? No. Kent, we seem to have lost Roderick.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, we had him here just a minute ago.
Was he on phone or?
Well, we tried both. He was having some connection issues, so we went with the phone. But apparently, okay. We've lost him on the phone as well.
Okay. Well, I wonder if he can hear us.
Oh gosh, darn it! You got to, you know, I have to laugh at this technology when I do this. We talk about being modern Amish, and. It's always an entertainment, and I'm really appreciative of your patience on this. But, Ken, how did you get into the electric vehicle situation?
Well, it's growing up like yourself in the 50s and 60s. I grew up in a small town in California, and cars were sort of, you know, that whole era. Also, there was a lot of things. I remember I had a Popular Science magazine subscription, and there were, in the sort of the mid to late 60s, there was sort of a flurry of battery vehicles, electric vehicles and stuff. And also, as slot cars were around, that was kind of relatively new, and different things that had batteries in them, and somehow it intrigued me. And anyway, somewhere, probably when I was around 12 or 14, I bugged the heck out of my father to build me an electric mini bike. So my first electric vehicle was somewhere around 64, 66. And it was a basic, you know, mini bike with a starter motor and a 6-volt battery on off switch.
Oh my. You know, we have a similar path, but my dad made me a little steam engine.
Oh, wow.
Cool. I still have the boiler got lost somewhere in one of our many, many moves, but I still have the little 2-cylinder steam engine my dad built for me.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The electric vehicle situation is intriguing. I think the infrastructure is one of the primary it's still a problem. It seems to be a holdup. But people don't, you know, we've got to realize that when the automobile, the infancy of the automobile, infrastructure was a problem all the way across the board, from lack of gas stations to lack of roads. At least we have roads now, or something that passes for roads.
It's interesting to correlate the development of the two fuels, electricity and non-electricity.
Where do you see this going? I know there's always a pushback when we try to move people from the familiar, the comfort zone. There's always a pushback. Let's see here. Are you still with us, Mr. Kent?
Yes, I am.
Okay, just 1 second here. Let's see. I think Roderick is trying this again. Are you with us, Roderick? I seem to have lost everybody here. Guys, this is not working very well. Oh my, Mr. Kent, we have got all kinds of problems today. I just lost all my cell signal.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm speaking of challenges with technology, here we are talking about electric vehicles and the challenges with infrastructure. And this morning I've had internet issues and phone issues.
It makes you want to just go out and put a crank in the front end and turn it over and make it go.
Oh, as you, well, you spoke volumes there. I just was joking with a car club the other day about this, how we've complicated vehicles unnecessarily. Henry Ford proved it. We don't need starters, fuel pumps, water pumps. There's so many things we just don't need. We just complicate our life immensely.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Roderick and you and Tasha and several others have now been involved with this Historic Electric Vehicle Foundation. You have a pretty ambitious goal of creating a Route 66 experience, this electric vehicle museum and educational facility here in Kingman. And I, for one, am really excited about this endeavor. But I think we're still a little bit of ways down the road on that.
You're right. There's a lot of work going into building up the infrastructure to get ready for this project. And, we're continuing to gather momentum and interest. At the same time, we're, to be quite honest, funding, dollars and cents are probably the biggest challenge coming up. And, but we're confident that there's enough interest in the museum and presentation that we will have something going in the next couple of years.
Yes, yes. Yeah, there's so much interest in this now, the electric vehicles. I was talking to Jay Leno earlier, and he's got kind of an interesting project. I don't know the status on this. He still hasn't got it on the road, but it's updating that Detroit Electric. Are you familiar with this?
Roderick's calling me. Can I connect him?
Yeah, if we can. Yes, please. This is, folks, I'm glad you guys are patient. We are having such problems this morning. It's almost like the old days when we had tin cans with string. That's kind of what I feel like today. With this project.
Yep. Is Roderick, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Finally.
Oh, Roderick, my phone, I lost my phone connection. I lost Kent. I lost you. We're almost down to tin cans and string here. And the irony of this is we're talking about the future of electric vehicles and technology, and we're having trouble with cell phones. You got to admire that. That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, but speaking of cell phones, if it wasn't for cell phone battery technology, which actually drove the development of new lithium batteries that now are in electric vehicles. So we got to thank the cell phone industry for that.
Well, I was reading, was it sodium iodine batteries? Is that correct? Is that the next technology that they're pushing down the pike?
I think it's actually the air battery, and Toyota, I think, is going to be coming out with that. So,
how is that different from your lithium?
The battery technology is advancing faster than I can comprehend it. It's amazing how fast it's developing. I mean, in the beginning, when I first got involved in electric cars, the holy grail was see if you could get over 100-mile range, you know, and average cars or conversions and things back there then were like 30 and 50 mile range, which is plenty good enough for commuting, you know, in your local neighborhood, but not for going cross country. Now people are going cross country in Teslas and other vehicles. So a lot's happened.
Well, you know, I've always been surprised that electric vehicles kind of waned for urban use, because I've always felt within reason, electric vehicles have been ideally suited for urban use. And that takes me to another thing I wanted to mention for you and discuss with you and Kent. It's surprising how many people think the oil companies were 100% responsible for the demise of early electric vehicles. And there's certain things I was really shocked to find that Gallup, Grants, New Mexico, the city did not have electricity until 1928. So I guess it would be kind of difficult to sell an electric vehicle in a town where you don't even have electricity at your house.
Yeah, that's true.
Kent, how did you get, we talked about your childhood interest in these vehicles, and now you're working to convert vintage vehicles to electric?
Yes, I'll throw in one thing, and I got my first electric after the mini bike, about 30 years later. Anyway, in 1994, there was a company in Seattle that was converting, they were restoring Volkswagen Beetles and also converting them to electric. And so I acquired a 1973 Beetle with a 96 volt lead acid battery system, and, you know, had about, on a good day, 25, maybe as much as 30 mile range. And I put about 20,000 miles on it at 25 miles at a time. So, and then it became and got connected to the Seattle Electric Vehicle Foundation or Association, and somewhere met Roderick during that journey. And my interest continued to grow. And when I was able to start working on other people's projects, converting, helping people out, that's what I continue to do. It's a hobby. It's not a business, but we're working on continuing to support the conversion of vintage vehicles into electric.
I know that's your primary business. Your primary business has been coffee associated. Is that correct?
That's true. I've been in the espresso coffee machine business basically my whole career.
That's not something you hear every day somebody say that I built my career and spent my time with espresso machines. It's not a real common career choice.
No, it's not. But I have to give Roderick a lot of credit, not only for developing the Historic Electric Vehicle Foundation, but also being an early promoter of electric vehicles. And I remember seeing some of his creations that were really stunning, especially for the time and the technology. So I'm sure he can share with us more of his journey.
Yeah, that's how Roderick and I got together, and I always apologize to Roderick every time we talk, because I got him I encouraged him to do this in Kingman, and I feel it's my fault.
Yeah, we'll blame it all on you. You always got to have a scapegoat, huh?
Yes, we got. Yes, 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 we do. But Roderick, you know, your work with the EVs, you're not only pioneering this, creating this awareness, but you've got quite a legacy behind you with creating a public awareness about electric vehicles. And I think that's quite admirable, because especially when you started doing this, boy, I tell you, you might as well have been talking about building flying saucers and head for the moon.
Yeah, when I first got my first electric car, it was so slow. I felt that no one is ever going to buy an electric vehicle. There's just no fun, you know? So I started working toward making them have more performance. And eventually by the late 90s, I was actually drag racing electric cars, and I did a show with Ryan Seacrest, and we blew the doors off the quickest production gasoline car in the world at that time, which was a Dodge Viper, 450 horsepower V10. And that's still on YouTube somewhere. But anyway, it went on from there. But now the speeds we were doing, which were incredible for them, like 11 seconds flat in the quarter, stock production Teslas are doing 10s.
The
whole family. They're like the old, you remember the old station wagons that had the back seat in the very back?
Yes.
You know, so you could put a couple of kids back there. Well, you know, they make Teslas like that, only they're modern. But, I mean, they hold that many people. So. Yeah. And yet they still do incredible ETs.
Now,
in a quarter mile.
John Whalen put together that white zombie, the Datsun. Is it true that he hit 0 to 60 in like 1.7 seconds with that? Do you know about that?
I don't know what it eventually did. I know it was real quick. I mean, my Maniac Mazda, the one I was beating Vipers with, was 0 to 60 in about 2.3. The launches were really heavy. My front wheels would come off the ground. They do, you know, I've seen them come off the ground on the white zombie mid-track, quarter mile, you know, when they shifted. I mean, it's just incredible to see something like that in a street-legal electric car, you know.
Well, you and I have had these conversations quite a bit. I've always been fascinated with the early history of the electric vehicles. And how many people were involved with these things. And the intersection of two of your hobbies is kind of a segue, is that fellow named Libby that came up with an electric assist bicycle back in the late 1890s. That kind of bridges both of your interests.
I picked up one recently that kind of bridges it also. I picked up mid-1880s, like about 1890, mid-1890s, about 1894, Waverly. And they started actually producing electric cars in 1898, I believe it was. And eventually they sold to Pope, who also made electric cars. But he was the main guy in the U.S. in the bicycle industry, you know. One of the biggest players before the turn of the century, and the movement after the Industrial Revolution just spawned all kinds of stuff. But the bicycle was the first time when people had the freedom to go travel to the next town, or you know, and women could actually get out on their own, and it just spawned a great deal of freedom, and it really changed the culture.
You say it's a Waverly bicycle?
Yeah,
would
Waverly.
That would get into the Pope Waverly? Would that?
Eventually, yeah. Pope bought out Waverly. I'm trying to remember the year, but I think it was after the turn of the century.
No,
1906, I think.
I can't remember his first name, but Pope ended up buying up. He created basically a General Motors type combine, buying up a lot of bicycle companies in mid-1890s. And then he went on and did the same thing with automobile companies after the turn of the century.
Correct.
Kent, do you have interest in these vintage bicycles, or is this a new realm for you?
This is a new realm, and I find it a little scary because between electric vehicles and a collection of coffee machines, I'm not sure I need another habit. But and I was pretty naive about it, but got to talking to Roderick about it. He sent me some pictures, and it's very intriguing, especially some of the crossover like you were talking about with the electric bicycle. So I'm staying away from bicycles for the moment, hoping I won't get fall into that rabbit hole. But it's fascinating.
Well, the, you know,
I'm going to stay away from collecting coffee machines also.
Well, I've got a. I'm one of these people. I'm kind of like a crap magnet. Everything's going to show up here, but I haven't got into coffee machines or bicycles yet. But I've got a collection of other things here that's a little bizarre. But that's another story for another day. You know, the entire auto industry, in fact, the U.S. highway system, the Good Roads Movement, all of that really is rooted in the bicycle mania of the 1890s. That's when we started having the big lobbying organizations, the League of American Wheelmen. And most of your early automotive pioneers got cut their teeth with bicycles. Barney Oldfield started racing bicycles before cars. Louis Chevrolet was manufacturing and racing bicycles. So a lot of these guys got started with that. And then, like, say, Mr. Libby kind of put the two together with electricity and bicycles. Kent, I have to ask, collecting and coffee machines, like how vintage coffee machines, espresso machines?
Basically, yeah, vintage commercial espresso machines and grinders. I have other smaller pieces, but the largest part of my collection is machines dating back to the teens. Espresso was kind of patented and started in around 1902 in Italy. So it's got a long, interesting history, mechanical history, etc. It uses some of the early machines were gas or coal fired, but electricity has become without electricity, we might not have coffee. Well, that's not entirely true, but
Kent didn't mention that he's also starting a coffee museum in Seattle, Washington.
Well,
maybe you can tell a little bit about that.
Sounds like it's a good place to get that thing going since, isn't that where Starbucks kicked off? It's up there in Seattle?
Yes. Seattle has a long history of coffee, and Starbucks is one of the companies started in 1970 along with a couple other. But, you know, cars and coffee seems to be a thing these days. So somehow, to me, it's a perfect combination, coffee machines and electric vehicles.
Well, it works. So you're thinking of a museum with chronicling the history of basically making coffee?
Well, I have a large collection, and yes, I do have a museum. It's under development, but it is. We have machines on display, and it's to tell the story of the development of espresso coffee and the stories of the people that helped to develop machines and different technology. And you know, that's the coffee as well as vehicles. There's like ourselves here on this call, there's people behind every device, and that's a much a part of the story that we want to tell, not only at my museum, but the Historic Electric Vehicle Foundation's Electric Vehicle Museum. And what's better than people and road trips and cars and stopping for coffee along the way?
Yes, yes. Now you've really got me thinking. There is a museum in Minden, Nebraska, surrounded by cornfields on US 6. It's an amazing museum. It's Harold Warp's Pioneer Village. I don't know if you're familiar with this.
No.
But it's a collection of everything. This fellow was outboard motors, snowmobiles, aircraft engines. But he has a complete display of the evolution of kitchens from the Franklin stove all the way up through the early 1960s. And they're complete exhibits with all the appliances, including like a refrigerator with a Crosley radio built into the door of the refrigerator. But now I'm curious if the, what those displays have for coffee making equipment. And I never paid attention when I was there because that just didn't click into my head. But now I'm curious.
Yeah. Which town is that in?
It's again? In Minden, Nebraska.
Nebraska, okay.
It's right on US 6.
All right, I'll have to check that out. That sounds pretty intriguing.
Yeah, that's a real intriguing museum. Roderick, how big is your bicycle collection now?
Ooh, can I say? As long as my wife's not listening. It's, I don't know, probably a couple hundred. Wow.
Wow. Wow, indeed. That's...
Going back to around 1868, just right after the Civil War. But they weren't called... I do have actually a replica of a 1837. That was the ones where you actually didn't have pedals. They just, used their feet. But the bone shakers came out in around the 1860s, and those had pedals on the front wheels, and they had wooden spoke wheels and steel rims. And, of course, on cobblestone, a steel rim on cobblestone will kind of shake your bones. So that's why I think they got the nickname Bone Shakers.
They're
also called velocipedes. So.
Are you familiar with, I can't remember his first name, but a fellow named Stevens back in the 1870s did an around-the-world trip on one of the high-wheel penny farthing bicycles. And wrote about his exploits. If you ever,
I haven't read that, but I'm aware of it.
I understand they're going to be reproducing his book, and I'm really looking forward to this. For folks, the old-fashioned bicycles that you've seen pictures of, where they've got a monstrous front wheel and a small back wheel, they call them the penny farthing bicycles, and Roderick can maybe fill us in on why. But this crazy SOB decided to take an around-the-world trip. He was even in Afghanistan with this thing. The sense of adventure, I guess, or there's a fine line between eccentricity and just nuttier than a truckload of praline.
After the bone shakers is when they developed those hot, they're also called high wheels. They were called penny farthings because of the relationship between the British coin, the farthing, and the penny. You had a little wheel in the back and a great big one in the front. And the reason for the big wheel was they wanted to go faster. I don't know where people got the idea of going faster, but somewhere along the line, people decided they wanted to go faster all the time. And I think that's what developed racing. But anyway, so they started racing these things, these early penny farthings. And of course, the bigger the wheels, because they didn't have chain gear drives or chains yet. So the only way you can make the bicycle go faster by cranking the wheel was to have a bigger wheel. So that's why you ended up with those kind of that style of bikes. But then they developed, those were called ordinaries, and then they developed what's called a safety bicycle. It's more like the bicycle you see nowadays, but they called them a safety bicycle because the penny farthings had the habit of being rather dangerous because you would hit a rock or something and you'd fly over the handlebars and land on your head. Well, yeah. And you'd land on your head from quite high in the air. So a lot of times it would result in death or at least... a cracked skull of some sort, but
okay, you're racing
before helmets and stuff, you know.
So you're sitting 4 or 5 feet off the ground on this bicycle that you're racing that has no brakes.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had brakes.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. Yeah. They rubbed, had a thing where you twist the handlebars, and this rope was wrapped around the handlebars. It would then go down through a pulley, and then it would go to a, it was called a spoon brake, and it was a spoon, a kind of elongated spoon affair that would rub on the front tire.
Oh, what could possibly go wrong?
You could break your string, I guess.
Break your neck. God. Yeah, we've talked about this before. And Kent, I don't know if I've shared this with you, but my grandfather was a prolific inventor in those years. And I have the patent applications for the coaster brake that he worked on in, I think, 1898.
Wow.
And that was kind of an intersection with Roderick and I as well.
Yeah, there was several people working on that at the same time, yes. Just like a lot of inventions around the world. They didn't come out on vehicles until on the bicycles until around 1898-99, right in there.
You know, one of the cars in your collection for the Historic Vehicle Museum that I really am intrigued by is the Henny Kilowatt. That is really a fascinating automobile. It's basically a Renault Dauphine, if I understand that correct, right? It's
Renault Dauphine, yeah.
How many of those were produced? They've got to be pretty rare.
They're real rare, yeah. We just had the one from the museum collection. It was actually donated by a guy in Utah that had started a collection, but he got ill with terminal disease and donated his entire collection to our museum. And we got a really nice example. It's, I think, it's only a few thousand miles on. It's like new. It was recently on display in the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. They had an interesting speed control, too. They had a series parallel system on the batteries where they had like 96 volts of batteries, but it was split up into two 48 volt packs. So they started out 48 volts and then switched to 96. You know, they'd start out in parallel and then switch them over to series to go faster.
You know, when you start talking about these different technologies with batteries, I want to thank you because it helps me feel even more ignorant. As I've been trying to decipher the wiring on a 51 Chevy pickup. And here we're talking about things like this. This Henny Kilowatt, the GM EV1 in the 90s. Any chance that we'll end up with one of those for the museum?
There's a possibility. We know of at least one that may become available or may be available. That we're looking into. So
was that car?
It'd be very nice to get one. I used to fly down to L.A. I had a friend down there, and he used to bring his EV1 to the airport and hand it over to me to use to drive all over the basin there to do, you know, business trips and stuff.
I kind of felt fortunate to
get to drive around in one of those.
Pretty advanced car for its time. Was that going to be a Saturn? Was that going to be done in their Saturn line, or was it a standalone, or what division of GM?
It was under the Saturn line at the time.
Yeah. Well, the Saturn division was sold
through Saturn dealerships. It wasn't sold. It was leased through Saturn dealerships.
The Saturn division during those early years, through the mid-90s, they were really doing some really innovative work and projects. Most intriguing. The hybrid cars, you know, of course, the Toyota Prius is one everybody talks about. But you were mentioning the Peterson Museum. I'm sure that you've seen down there in the vault at the Peterson, they have one of the Woods Dual Power from 1916. In the vault?
Yeah.
The Woods Hybrid?
I know about it, but I haven't seen it.
It's a pretty intact car. It's unrestored. It's an interesting car. to say the very least. Woods is one of those companies that somehow fell through the cracks, and they definitely, they definitely made huge contributions to the auto industry as a whole and urban transportation. My dad always told me it was better to fill your head with useless knowledge than no knowledge at all. And I recently learned that the first car imported into Hawaii was a Woods Electric.
Wow. Yeah, that's something I didn't know.
No.
You have to send me the info on that, definitely. Yeah,
I just stumbled into that. Kent, Roderick, any final thoughts? First of all, I got to thank you both. You're very patient. And Kent, I knew you were a patient man, but 20,000 miles on an electric Volkswagen, that's a monument to your patience.
It'd be interesting to know what Roderick is. I've heard about other people that have gone five times that far in the early, in the recent history before lithium batteries and stuff. It's pretty amazing what, and then the electrophones, that's a whole nother topic, but I'll let Roderick weigh in on that.
The electric go ahead, Roderick.
I just wanted to put in a plug for the Historic Electric Vehicle Foundation, that it's really moving ahead quite rapidly. Now, there was a time when, after we lost Larry, he was my good friend, and he was also, Larry Fisher was, he was also the executive director of the Wally Parks Motorsports Museum, the NHRA Motorsports Museum there in Pomona, California. But he was I consider him co-founder. When I first had the idea for the museum, my first person I called was Larry, and I said, I got this idea, but I won't go anywhere with it, but I won't move forward unless you agree to be involved. And he agreed, and so that's how it started. But anyway, now a couple of supporters have stepped up the plate and purchased a couple of the historic buildings in downtown Kingman's, quite near our proposed future site of the museum, which is only like less than a block away. It's really close, but they purchased these two buildings with the intent of leasing them back to the foundation with eventually a lease option so that the foundation can own them. But anyway, they're just beautiful. Well, one of them is a very beautiful building. It's a Mission Spanish Revival style, yes. Built in 1922. It's the old Oddfellows Hall. It's just an absolutely beautiful building. And right now the HEVF has a full-time employee there, Tasha O'Neill, and she's we have an office there now in Kingman, and they also picked up the 1922 original fire station.
Yes.
Which I assume will someday be restored, at least the facade restored and stuff. But anyways, definitely things are moving ahead rather rapidly, and we'll be starting to do some fundraising and so we can build this new world-class museum so people fly into Las Vegas from all over the world and come down and visit it.
Roderick, that's a testimony to your tenacity and your patience, because I know that since 2014, that's been a real dream and a project. And that's there again, tenacity and patience.
Well, we have a lot of new volunteers now on our board, and we got Kent, and we got an advisor, Jeff Finn, and things are just really looking up. I mean, there was a period, a dark period there after Larry passed, that I was kind of down at the dumps about the whole project, and I'm really glad to see this finally moving ahead now.
I am too.
Well, in some worlds, some worlds you might call it breakneck speed, but breakneck speed is really slow turtle pace, you know, as far as all the stuff that has to be done. But to me, after years and years of this, it seems like it's going pretty fast to me.
Good. Roderick, thank you for doing this morning, and thank you for your patience. And we hope when you get back to from Croatia that we can get together for some coffee. And Kent, I really appreciate your patience on this today. I know you're a fan of the podcast, and this is probably one of the most trouble-plagued programs I've done yet. And yet, with your patience, we managed to put something together here that I think will inspire people and encourage people and maybe even give them the answer to some questions on Jeopardy.
I hope they take home something.
And Kent, I look forward to our next visit and kicking around some of these ideas, discussing some different things and talking about coffee and electric vehicles and what the future holds.
Thank you, Jim. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Yeah, I have enjoyed this immensely, and I'm most appreciative, gentlemen. Thank you very, very much. We've had a great bunch of folks here today. Greg Hassman, journalist from Albuquerque, is with us this morning. He's had a little bit of difficulty, apparently, but he's on the road coming back to Albuquerque from Lincoln, New Mexico. And Maggie May is with us this morning from East Lansing, Michigan. She is with the R.E. Olds Museum up in East Lansing. So we've got some interesting people here that I think you've piqued their interest, and see what kind of partnerships that turns up. Because, was Mr. Hey, real quick before we go, speaking of R.E. Olds, I know Olds was involved with steam power before he turned to gas. Was Ransom Olds ever involved much with electric vehicles? Anybody?
Not that I've heard of.
It just popped into my head. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah.
Oh, Maggie said he was. Oh, well, now we've got a new chapter. Very good. Thank you, Maggie. Kent, Roderick, again, thank you. I'm really appreciative because, like I say, this morning has been a little challenging, shall we say, a little stressful on my end. But thanks to you, you guys actually made me look like I knew what I was doing. And I really am appreciative. Gentlemen, I'll let you go. Thank you for taking time for your schedule. Next week, we're going to be talking to Steve Roth of Quattro Publishing. We're going to be talking about the changing face of the publishing industry, e-books, the Route 66 Centennial, travel books, automotive books. And the week after that, we'll be talking to Dora Maroney with the Texas Route 66 Association. And we're working. We haven't got it pinned down yet, but we'll probably be talking to the tourism director and the mayor in Needles, California, the week after that. And then I might be taking the program on the road for a couple weeks, but we'll see how that pans out. Gentlemen, again, thank you. And we'll do this again next week at 7, and let's see what kind of troubles we have then.
Hope to meet up with you in Kingman.
I look forward to it. And Kent, I look forward to seeing you both. Bye-bye, my friends. Adios.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Folks, there we go. We got gonna music from Joe Road Crew. And I want to thank your patience as our audience today, because the first, this has been one for the record books, and your patience was truly appreciated. But I hope you found the show informative and entertaining. We're going to be hoping that Roderick, he's making a pretty good recovery. He has a little bit of health issues there in Croatia, but we're looking forward to him getting on his feet, and we're looking forward to hearing more about Kent's project with a coffee machine museum. Hey, any final thoughts before we go? We have room for a call in or notes. And if not, well, I will button this up and we'll talk again tomorrow. I hope you guys really enjoyed this as much as I did once we got it going. So, till next week, adios, my friends.